morning and good evening. We'll go with good evening. This is the Monroe City Council meeting for Tuesday, May 12th, and the time is about 7:04 p.m. Ms. Moot, will you call the roll, please?
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Cutaback, Rasmussen, Camp, Gamble, and Garen.
Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen. Oh, and we heard last week from Councilmember Davis that he would not be here this evening. So without objection, we will consider that absence as excused. And well, I have not yet heard from Councilmember Hanford. And I think that's it for now. Councilmember Rasmussen, will you lead us in the pledge? Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And, before we begin this evening, please note that the microphones have been changed. In that for you to speak into your microphone and be picked up, you'll want to lean forward and push the button. The green light means that the microphone is picking you up. When it's dark, that means that the microphone is not. So please remember to push those buttons. If you'd like, you can just keep it on for the whole meeting. But green means speak. Okay, the first item that we have on this evening's agenda is under presentations. This is the Monroe Fire District. Chief Silva. Chief. Thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you. I don't have a green button over here. So I'd like to just give an overview of the fire district for those that don't know the history and where we're at, and then kind of go over some response times, a little bit of our fire station study we did back in 2009, and then kind of our finances and kind of show the forecasting model. So first, we used to be a joint operating board. We had three city council members and three fire commissioners that ran the fire department. And then in 2006, we went to the vote of the people and they annexed the city fire department into the fire district. So now we're governed by five fire commissioners that are elected by the people. We cover 55 square miles. We go south to King County line, north to 100th Street. So if we get to four addresses, it's not in our fire district and somewhat in the middle of Snohomish and Salton. The lines aren't straight, as you know. Last year, our alarms, we ran 3,430 calls in our fire district, and 70% of those are EMS calls. We have 40 union firefighters, 2 exempt employees, 25 part-time employees. We used to call them volunteers, but they're all paid part-time. And then we have 3.5 admin staff. We established response objectives, and we started with our turnout time, and that goes from the time that we're dispatched till the time we go on route, and we set that for 1:45, and we actually last year crunched our numbers, and we're at 1:38, so we reached our objective. In the city, we have our response times, which is from the time the alarm goes off till the time that we arrive, the first unit arrives, and in the city, we set that time for 5 minutes, and for 14, we're at 4:41, so we meet our objective. In the city, in the district, which is much bigger, further, and we only have 2 fire stations, we set that at 8 minutes, and we did not meet that objective as it took us 9:38, and we know that's a shortfall, and that's something that gives us something to work forward to, and I'll kind of touch that on that later when we talk about the station study that we did in 2009. Any questions so far?
No.
So we're going to the fire station study. In 2009, we hired a company to come out, emergency ESI, and they came out and did a study, and we looked at 2 things. We wanted to try to put a fire station within 5 miles of everybody in our fire district. And the reason for that is everybody's homeowner's insurance typically used the Washington Survey and Rating Bureau. And if you're not within 5 miles of a fire station, you're automatically classed as a 9, so your insurance goes up. So we looked at that, and then we also took our call load and we stuck it in the map and seen where we were. So we addressed 3 more stations. We currently have 2 stations. We have the headquarters station right behind us. We have station 2, which is up at Wagner Road at 132nd Street. And then the third station, they said that we needed to put on the north side of the tracks by the fairgrounds. And we actually looked at property. It actually was Sherry Harris's property, but our architect said run, because there's salmon spawning creeks and gas lines. So we do have a piece of property that we received through mitigation through the Frylands development. It's out in the Frylands property. We still have that, but I think the goal was to try to look at putting it on the other side of the tracks. So we worked with the county and Tom Tegan from the Parks Department, and we're in their comp plan to hopefully someday do something jointly with an admin building and a fire station on the fairground site. So with the fair being so active and we operate as a paint station there during the fair, it just seems like a natural thing. The fourth station is out on Florence Acres Road, and they identified between 243rd, which is the Cast Road, and 259th, somewhere in there. So that's actually the piece of property our commissioners want us to start looking at now to purchase the property. And then the fifth station would be south of town, somewhere around 203rd Street and SR 203. We actually had some property identified before the economy took a dip. As the economy got better, we went out and PUD actually bought the property we're looking at for the substation. So it's tougher out there with the flooding, and we're trying to get down lower instead of on the hill. So we're back looking at purchasing property. We don't see ourselves building a station in the near future, and I'll show that when we get into the finances. So any questions so far? So 86% of our revenue comes from property taxes. The assessed value of the fire district in 2009 was $3.7 billion. Today, after we've had two positive years of growth in the assessed AV, our assessed value in the fire district is $2.9 billion. So we still haven't made ground to where we were in 2009. But the expenses are not the same. They're actually more, as you can figure. Our statutory limit for our EMS levy, so we have two typical levies, one for our fire site, which is the expense levy. We can go to $1.50 per thousand of our assessed value. Our EMS levy, we can go to 50 cents. Well, when the property value started dropping, the price per thousand went up, and we started losing money in 2010. So then in 2012, we went to the voters to ask for a maintenance and operation levy. And we gave them the option, do you want to keep the same service, or do you want us to lay people off and don't want to pay more taxes? And they supported us. And $2.25 million levy, a four-year levy, expires at the end of next year. So I'm going to show you this forecasting model. We've used this since 2004. This is designed by Bill Cushman. He's known throughout the state of Washington and the nation for developing this robust forecasting model. It takes all our expenses, all our revenues, and it takes our property taxes and forecasts it out to see where we're going to be. And so we use this in the early years before the economy took a crash to plan and how we're going to, you know, spend money and budget for stuff. And then all of a sudden, in about 2000, first part of 2009, we started seeing, whoa, something could happen here. So we started playing with the model to say, what could it do if the property taxes started dropping, the property values? So that actually had us saying, okay, we'll quit spending in 2009. And through this process, we were able to get through without laying any firefighters off. And we haven't hired any staff since 2008 that we hired on a safer grant. So we haven't increased staffing. We're lucky to maintain our current staffing. You know, during that time when we went out for the M&O levy, I had to look and say, well, do we have too many people? And, you know, we have two stations that are staffed full-time. One structure fire takes all our on-duty staff and takes them away. One motor vehicle accident takes our on-duty staff and takes them out of service. So that second call, there's nobody there. And if we're in a city, you know, like in Mill Creek or something where they have cities next to them, for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, they have another fire engine from a different agency that, you know, are in their district. Where we're 12 to 15 minutes, so it takes a long time. So we knew that at that time we weren't going to, we didn't want to lay people out, and that's what had us go to the voter, you know, to the people and ask what level of service could they. So here, we start off with
Councilmember Camp has a question, and then Councilmember.
I'm just curious. Before you continue, for the record, Councilmember Hanford came in at 7:12 just now. Please go ahead, Councilmember Camp.
No, that's fine. So when you say that you didn't increase staff, that includes their part-time employees as well?
Well, they come and go, and actually we probably decreased our part-time employees.
I'm sorry, decreased or increased?
Decreased. We've got less part-time employees than we had before. It's harder to keep them, especially recently. Some of the departments, the economy's gotten better, and some of the firefighters that could have retired prior to 2009 and 10, they kept their jobs, and now they're seeing a lot of attrition. So these part-time employees, most of them, the reason they're doing it is so they can get a career job.
Right.
And so we're seeing a lot of them get hired away to departments that are finally hiring firefighters.
So essentially becoming a training organization for other fire districts.
Correct. And everybody uses, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're Marysville or you're Getchell Fire Department, Gold Bar, we don't use part-time employees. They rotate around, and then, you know, for young kids that want to get in the fire service,
right.
It's a great opportunity.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutterback.
Thank you. Chief, what is the, and maybe I might be asking this too early, but what's the operating revenue? What does that entail?
I'll get to that.
Okay. And then, so you'll get to that, but the maintenance and operation levy, you said it runs out at the end of next year, which I see up there. But then it looks like you're running at a deficit after that. Are you, your intent would be to replace that?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So we start off here with our fund balance, and of course it does show our property taxes, our M&O levy. As you can see, our M&O levy ends in 2017. It goes to zero because it expires after 4 years. We have our revenues, and when you get down to the ending balance, we need to have a balance of $1.5 million. We own, as I said, 86% of our revenue is property taxes, and people pay their property taxes in April and October. So we have to have money to run in between those times. So whenever you see it get below $1.5 million, it means that we're already in a deficit. It doesn't have to go into negative numbers. So you know, this isn't a trend in the whole fire service. This isn't a problem that just Monroe has. Even when you see in cities, you know, like I know Bothell's looking at doing an RFA and getting rid of their fire department. Every fire's looking. Linwood and District 1, Fire District 1 are actually in talks right now about doing an RFA. You know, it's just, I think the trend with the economy, you guys haven't got back to where you were, and you know, if you kind of put it on its own, on fire service on its own, doing an RFA, then it doesn't take taxes and stringent the city. So that's what we're starting to see a lot of. And we're starting to see a lot of different organizations, fire districts working together to try to save money. And we're actually doing that with Fire District 7, Mulvey-Mill Creek, Clearview area. So we'll go down here. And the next thing is, we'll go to the property tax model. And every November, the assessors send me a certification for my levies. And they tell us all what, you know, and you guys get the same thing about what our property values are going to be, what are state assessed utilities, new construction, all that stuff for the next year. So this program right here actually takes all the stuff in that sheet that we get. And so the top part, I wish I had a mouse because it would be a little quicker. The top part is the expense levy, and then the bottom part is my EMS levy. And I'm not going to get into this depth, but so we put in there the green, where anything in this program that's green is where you hard code stuff. If it's colored, it means that it's a form. So we have throughout, we have the legislative increase that we can do to 1%. So through this model, this does include a 1% increase for every year commissioners have done that. Prior to 2001, we could go to 6%. And then when you come up here, you can actually look with what we think that values are going at. And in 20, if I look over here, in 2016, we're anticipating another 8% increase, and we don't know that until about July that the assessor will give us that number. And then we start to figure a modest 5%. And it's a guess. I mean, nobody knows, and we think, you know, we're not trying to, you know, be irresponsible and be too conservative, or, you know, or be the other way. So about 5%. And one thing with the forecasting model, when you start to get more than 5 years, you're really guessing. But the nice thing is we update this every year. So then one thing you can see up here, when we come up to the top, you can start to look at our levies here. So the top one is our expense levy, and as you can see, the price per thousand, because the assessed values are going up, is actually going down, which is a good thing. So we're not at our statutory limit. And then same with the EMS levy. So for 2016, we're predicting it to be $1.20 per thousand. And the EMS levy, we're looking at 40 cents per thousand. So then we come in and we put in our revenues, and as I said, 86% of our revenues are property taxes. And then the rest is all in here, a gamut of everything from our EMS transports for when we transport somebody in the hospital, the prison, we have a contract with the prison, we have a contract with the county, because they don't pay taxes towards fire service, towards fire protection, and a bunch of miscellaneous revenue stuff. And then we come to our expenses, and we have our expenses summarized as our budget is, and then down lower, it goes into our line budget. And then we can go over to the right, and we have inflators. And this is the same with our revenue, is that we can go out and predict what do we think it's going to raise, like what's wages going to be and what's benefits, because we know that about 80% of our budget is benefits. So that takes care of trying to forecast our normal operating expenses. Then we have our capital fund, and this has got three different things that it has. So one-time expense stuff, it has stuff that's ongoing like apparatus replacement. We have a life expectancy of about 20 years on a fire engine, and we just bought two new ones, and they're $640,000 a piece, not counting the equipment that goes in them. And so in this program, as we put equipment in it, so these are scheduled replacements. This is all our apparatus. This says how long we want to have it, and it gives an inflator factor. So later down the road, you save the money up for what it's really going to cost you, 10 years or 20 years down the road. And then we have another section that's a one-time purchase. And then these are, we're not renewing these purchases. They're things that are being surplus and going away. So we put everything into our capital fund. And then we have a lead buyout fund. And as per the auditor, as it always happens, somebody probably didn't pay somebody their benefits when they retired, and so they come around and look at all of us. And so our commissioners, and by policy, by resolution, established that they would keep 25% of our total liability in a fund. And so what we do at the end of every year is we look at people's vacations, their comp time, their sick leave hours based on how the buyback is with their contract. And we make sure that we have 25%. Plus, in this program, we go down and we anticipate who's going to retire and when they're going to retire, and try to anticipate worst case scenario of if we have to buy them out so that we can have the funds to pay them. And then the last thing is we're self-funded health care insurance. So we are our own health care whistle stop loss protection. And so we have a health care fund so we can track the money coming in and out. And out of the last 4 years, we've only had one bad year, so knock on wood. And we saved the taxpayers over $500,000 the first 2 years that we changed from the Washington Fire Commissioners to our self-insured, same benefits, nothing changed. So the problem is that we now look at this, and this is a tool for the commissioners, and this has been presented to the commissioners, and they're used to this because we've used it since 2004. But as we start to come up to next year at this time, we're going to be gearing up to run the M&O levy. So we have to come up with a plan. How do we get out of the deficit? What do we do? And have a plan to tell the taxpayers so that, you know, they can choose if they want to support us in that way or ask us to cut services. So we either cut services or we get revenues. I mean, that's the only two options. So we're going to come down here, and we know that the first thing we have to do is we have to come up and we have to renew our M&O levy. Our goal is we were hoping to ask for less, but with today's numbers and looking at everything, we can't. We're going to ask for the same thing. So we're going to ask for another $2.25 million. So that automatically put it out for 4 years, and if you go back and look at our fund ending balance, it takes us out to a balance of $2 million in 2020, and that's when this levy would expire. So that helps us so we don't have to do anything else. The problem is when you start looking down the road is how do we, you know, manage. Now, the one thing is this, we do have for new construction, and I know reading the paper, sometimes people think we're the next Linwood or Bothell, and there's going to be tons of growth, and if that happens, then we'll adjust this, and that'll help later on how much money we go ask the taxpayers for. We have shown growth and an increase in new construction in this program. So the next thing is that we need to go and we need to fund these funds that we came in here. And as you can see in our capital fund that we're going to be broke in 2018, we won't have any money in our capital fund to buy fire engines. Playing with this, one of the ideas that we came up with, and what I'm teaching is just showing you there's options, and this is kind of what we've done to balance it, but when the time comes, the commissioners are going to make the decision to say how we're going to do it. So, but we figured if we start 2017, and we start to put $500,000 a year in our year. Then when you come back and look with everything we put in there, we put everything in there from our SCBAs. There's laws how long a self-contained breathing apparatus that we wear on our back when fires last, and you have to upgrade them. It's going to be about $400,000. We've been fortunate over the years. We've gotten over $2 million in grants for a new tender, SCBAs, radios, a gamut of things. But that stuff's starting to dry. We still write grants for them, but they're not as plentiful as they were. But if I put $500,000 into a capital fund, we can see that we keep ourselves in the positive. There's one little year that we're a little low, but we're not concerned with that because we usually have carryover from our expense fund. We never spend it down to $0, so that helps with that. And then our lead buyout fund, we go in here and we know that we want to put starting at $17,600. And then when we do that, we know that we cover our expenses. Put it up here. So 17. So if we look at it now, we can come up here and we can look at our balance, and it covers the expenses that we have in there up to 2024, and it also keeps us a buffer of that 25% that we have to have in there to pay our liability. But if we do that and we put that money, then we come and look at our fund balance, and you can see that we start to run into problems. Remember last time after the M&O, we were still balanced out to 2020, but when we funded those funds, now we're not balanced to 2020. So that means that we can't just live in the next 4 years off of an M&O levy, unless we cut services. So then what we have to do is come over and say, okay, well, we know that our property for expense levy went down to $1.11, so we said, okay, well, let's go to $1.45. We just raised in 2018 to $1.45, and then we come back and we look at our fund.
Yeah, I'm curious.
When you say cut services, I'm sorry, but I think of the fire department going out and putting out fires. What would you be cutting?
The way you save money is you have to lay people off.
Oh, okay, so yeah. You'd actually be losing staff.
We'd lose staff, and then we'd cut your service because you would have to wait for mutual aid to...
So it's the response time.
Correct.
Would be it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so now you can look, and you can see that by raising the expense levy in 2018, that we can now balance up through 2021 when the M&O levy expires. And we know that, you know, we're going to have to probably keep that going. Now, if Monroe grows, like they say, with the new construction, then we can tweak this and maybe that'll change. But we have a plan that we can sell to the taxpayers when we go out and say, here's our option, or, like I said, these pet services. Any questions on the forecasting model at all?
Council?
Nope.
So, the one thing I wanted to end with is something that we are working with Fire District 7 on, and you probably read it in the Everett-Herald about a community resource paramedic. Has anybody read that article that Fire District 1 got a grant from Verdant for the Swedish Hospital? And it's, you know, when you look at the EMS system, there is a big hole, because we have frequent users, our high-risk citizens, we go on them a lot, we take them to the hospital, the nurses get mad at us, why are you bringing them here? They, you know, send them home, we pick them up, we take them back because we can't leave them at home. And really what it comes down to is the system's broke, and we got to get back, almost like community policing, we got to get back to the community paramedicine. We got to help those people and get them to the right resources. So we've been working with Evergreen Hospital in Kirkland and Monroe, and they're supporting us, and they're looking for some grant funding. But ourselves and Fire District 7 have agreed to share funds, and our goal is to start this program and mirror it off. What Fire District 1 has done has been fantastic. Starting August 1st, and it'll be for us to go out to our citizens, and what they thought was is they would first go out to their high-risk users, the people they utilize a lot, and they did. But they find themselves that they end up going where the firefighters go. There's a sheet the firefighters go on a call, they see Grandma Smith who can't take care of herself, and then they will give it to the community paramedic, They'll contact them, their family, give them resources, how this person can get help. And so we're excited about that program that we're going to lead to increase the service that we give to our citizens. That's what I was going to end with. Is there any other questions?
Any other questions, comments, council? Councilmember Cutterback.
Chief, just a question. You mentioned the going to 5 fire stations in the future, but you didn't give a timeline. You said it was a ways out. Do you have any idea? We had a woman speak here at council maybe a month ago.
2 weeks ago.
Was it 2 weeks ago? Yeah, who mentioned that. I mean, her husband passed away because care wasn't.
Right, that was what we discussed.
Correct, and I don't have the details on that. I mean, so yeah. It's hard to comment on it. And did she live in our fire district? And, you know, we do have a station on each side of the train tracks. I know the train was an issue, but, you know, they do go on other calls. And
well, that was my question, I guess, for Wagner being open. It's open 24-7
correct.
Up there? Okay.
We have 3 firefighters, well, a captain, a paramedic, and a firefighter up there. And they cross-staff an engine and a medic unit. So they're up there, depending on what type of call they go in.
Okay. All right. I was curious about that. But no timing of capital, like for the Florence Acre one that you mentioned? Or
no, we're actually looking at purchasing the property sooner than later. We actually, in our capital fund, we have some land money that we have set aside to go do that. Because we don't, you know, the worst thing we can do is eminent domain, and this property starts, you know, disappearing and getting developed, and we're going to look like the bad guys. So that is our goal, to go out and secure the property on Florence Acres Road and start looking south of town. We do have the Freilands property, and we're hoping that we can do something, and we're, you know, work with the county, so hopefully we're in their comp plan, and something can happen there.
Yeah, I think the fairgrounds idea with the fire station there makes wonderful sense, so I think that's a wonderful direction. But I also wanted to thank you for all the service you guys do. I work for an organization that calls the EMS, the fire department, quite a bit, because we have a wide range of people coming in who need a lot of help, so I appreciate the work you do. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if I could schedule the calls, it would be a lot easier. I'm going to call at 8. So we run a lot of back-to-back calls. We run 3 calls at one time. And one thing we do is, because our mutual aid is so far away, is we allow, well, our part-time employees can come back, but we allow our paid staff to come back when we get down below 2 people on duty. So if they're on a call, then we have what's called a manpower tone, and they can come back and run that, you know, 3rd or 4th rig that needs to happen if there's that 4th call.
All right, thank you. The next item that we have on our agenda is a proclamation. This is for Public Works Week. Whereas public works infrastructure, facilities, and services are of vital importance to sustainable communities and to the health, safety, and well-being of the citizens of Monroe. Whereas such facilities and services would not be provided without the dedicated efforts of public works professionals, engineers, managers, and employees from both the public and the private sectors, who are responsible for and must plan, design, build, operate, and maintain the transportation, water supply, wastewater treatment, and solid waste systems, public buildings, and other structures and facilities essential to serve the citizens of Monroe. And whereas it is in the public interest for citizens and civic leaders to gain knowledge of and to maintain a progressive interest and understand the importance of public works and public works programs in the city of Monroe. And whereas 2015 marks the 55th annual National Public Works Week, sponsored by the American Public Works Association, now therefore I, Jeffrey Thomas, Mayor of the City of Monroe, do hereby proclaim the week of May 17th through the 23rd, 2015, as Public Works Week in the City of Monroe. And I urge all people in the community to join me in honoring our public works professionals, engineers, managers, and employees, and recognizing the substantial contributions they have made to our health, safety, welfare, and quality of life. So, Brad, thank you very much. All right. Thank you. The next item we have on our agenda is comments from citizens. This is a time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe, except any quasi-judicial matter subject to a public hearing. There is 5 minutes per speaker allowed. Are there any members of the public that would like to come forward to speak? Anybody at all? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the consent agenda. Council? Councilmember Rasmussen.
Motion to approve consent agenda.
Second.
I have a motion to approve the consent agenda from Councilmember Rasmussen and a second from Councilmember Cuddeback. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Seeing none, motion passes 6-0. Next item on the agenda is unfinished business. This is AB 15088, Discussion 2015 Comprehensive Plan. This is a consultant briefing. So, Mr. Osaki, we'll start.
Well, Mayor, members of the council, before Bill Grimes from Studio Cascade gives a presentation on the comprehensive plan, let me just say a few words on where we are right now, especially where the Planning Commission is. So the Planning Commission opened up a public hearing April 20th, and continued the public hearing to May 4th, and continued the public hearing again until last night. And last night there were a couple other individuals that provided testimony to the Planning Commission. And at that point in time, the Planning Commission has closed the public testimony portion of its public hearing. It's now working on deliberation and fact findings in order to give a recommendation to the City Council. Planning Commission is working off of the policies that were provided to the public and to you as well on April 2nd as part of the document that was handed out to you in April. So that's the baseline document with policies and goals that the Planning Commission is working off of. They know that you as a council would like to get the recommendation sometime like beginning of June. So I don't know how many more meetings they're going to have between now and the end of this month and the beginning of June to work through those policies. But I'm sure they're pretty committed to getting that done. So now is actually a good time for the consultant to give you as a council kind of a presentation and a refresher on the plan and what's happened to date, focusing less on what's happened to date as much as what I've asked the consultant to do is give you the background on what are the key strategies, key land use strategies in the comprehensive plan, and basically what really makes this plan different from the plan that the city has adopted. To talk a little bit about what really needs to happen between now to the point of getting this plan adopted, including responding, I believe, to your comment about when do you see some of the comments that you've had as a council, some of the changes that you've asked for so far. And then finally, even though it's not part of the consultant's scope of work, to talk about what needs to happen after the plan gets adopted, because the work does not stop once the plan gets adopted. And in fact, most communities have two ways to deal with the update to the Growth Management Act with their comprehensive plan. One is to just do amendments to their existing plan, and other communities are going similar to what Monroe is doing, is basically doing an entirely new plan. And so this entirely new plan means there are some new plan designations, there are some plan designations that are going away, and ultimately that gets implemented through your zoning. So there's going to be some major work that has to be done as a next step in terms of your zoning code and your zoning map, and Bill will talk about that as well. So at this point I'll introduce Bill, and I'll be available to answer questions when Bill's done with this presentation.
All right. Thank you, David. Let me fire up this. I do have a PowerPoint.
That's fine.
What would planner be without a PowerPoint? Okay. Give me a while. It's warming up. It's warming. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Mayor, Council. Good to see you again. David and I were talking on the phone the other day, and he thought it would be a good idea to have something of a nuts and bolts presentation to council, now that it looks like the plan is taking shape, close to getting a recommendation from the Planning Commission on where to head. Looking in some detail at what the plan proposes, how it differs from what you have on the books now, and what my promise for implementation steps ahead. So, let's see if it's working. Yes. So, talking about the individual components of the comprehensive plan, some of the recent changes that have occurred as part of the Planning Commission's deliberation. Again, tying into why some of these changes really have been suggested as part of the plan, and then looking in some detail at the implementation steps, both the near term and the long term horizon. Break into a council conversation. there, David and I will be happy to answer questions. So how we got here, I'm not going to spend much time on this at all, but I do think it's important to honor that process that led us to the plan that we have, and remembering that it is a plan that's more than just a comprehensive plan. It's also a capital facilities plan, a parks recreation, open space plan, transportation plan, economic development strategy, and it's also appended with a utilities master plan that Public Works has put together. So we've had a couple of websites. We had a dedicated project website, and we also had, for the first two-thirds of the process, a Mind Mixer website where people were able to comment in, send in photographs, add blog comments on different different topics that were coming out of the process. We also broke this process down into five separate focused capsules. Many of you attended different capsule activities where we had concentrated advisory committee meetings, and we also had public workshops where we invited Parks Board members, planning commissioners, our citizens advisory committee members, council members, and the general public to talk about each of those individual topics that came together as part of the plan. We also ran a week-long studio last June. Hard to believe it was almost a year ago, but we ran a week-long studio where members of the public could visit with the consulting staff and weigh in on different land use alternatives and strategies. And then we had several joint workshops. Well, we had two of those. We had one in June. We had another one in January. And since then, it's been propelled into the Planning Commission desk, and they've been meeting at least six times on this plan to work through policies and make sure that it's fine-tuned and heading in the correct direction. And it's also been a discussion topic before council, so that you've been able to work through some of the goals, give us a foundation of vision and goals to work through in the plan, and you've been keeping current with the process of the planning agency conversation, or sorry, planning commission conversation. So the plan, just the plan document itself, consists of 10 chapters. The first five chapters include two that are required by the Growth Management Act, Land Use and Transportation Plan, but the city's elected to include an economic development element as well, which is a companion piece to the city's economic development strategy. We also have housing elements and capital facilities and utilities, which are two additionally required elements from the Growth Management Act. But we're including a parks, recreation, and open space element that is a companion to your parks, recreation, open space plan. So you're fulfilling the policy guidance requirement there. And then we also have a shorelands and natural environment chapter. Now, I should note that both the economic development element and the parks, recreation, open space element are technically required by the Growth Management Act, but they're also technically not required by the Growth Management Act because it hasn't been funded by the state for local agencies to prepare them. So the state really likes to see these in your comprehensive plans, and the city of Monroe has included them in its plan. And then our final chapter in the comprehensive plan document is an implementation chapter where we identify some of the next steps to move the plan forward. The plan also has several appendices, and this is where we get into including the other components of this planning effort that really make it comprehensive in every sense of the word. We have an integrated environmental impact statement as part of this plan, so you will not have a standalone environmental document. It's actually in here, which is nice and convenient for people who care about environmental impact statements. They can see a direct reference between policies and the environmental actions, mitigation measures that are attached to them. We proposed in our April 3rd document in Appendix B, where we had a goal, policy, and action matrix, which really was the bones and muscle of the plan. Sometimes we have an appendix that includes definitions and a glossary, a list of acronyms, or an LOA. Sorry, it's a bad joke. Acronyms. Anyway, but we don't have it in this document. We could, of course, add one if it's something you wanted. We have a statement of the planning process in our Appendix D, and then we have a transportation plan, our economic development strategy, and our parks recreation plan, which are topically focused planning documents. We've also included the utilities capital facilities plan, which deals with water, wastewater, and stormwater, and then we also have a capital facilities plan that deals with public services that the city or other private utility providers supply to Monroe. So, in all, it's a massive document, but we're going to talk about the plan really that is really indexing all of the other material that you'll see. So the changes that the Planning Commission has been working on and working on diligently really focus on the policy framework and how we communicate that. We actually talked about that here at City Council level, where the Planning Commission wanted to see a reorganization so that the policies weren't distributed throughout the individual elements, but that they are actually more closely nested into those 8 goals that override the entire plan. So they've been working on recategorizing and realigning those policies so that they fit nicely in. So if you have a question about how to implement a goal, you can go right to a policy that references directly to that goal. The Planning Commission has asked that we pull that into Chapter 2. So Chapter 2, I mean, if the comprehensive plan is an index to all of the other plans that have been done as part of this process, then Chapter 2 is an index to the plan. So Chapter 2 will give you that vision statement, and it will also give you the goals, policies, and implementation actions to fulfill the overall planning direction. So some of the work that we've been doing is kind of wonkish associated with that, where we've tried to make sure that the restructuring of the plan accurately represents the cross-referencing, so that when you're in Chapter 2 and you're pointed to another element, it gives you a little bit more information that link is complete and communicates the ideas and concepts effectively. So that's really what we've been doing since this April 3 draft, which I believe you all received a copy of. So just as something of a reminder, some of the policy shifts that we have in this plan is that we're trying to find ways to make Monroe grow within its limits, essentially, so we get a little bit more diversity, a little bit more complexity. We start to emphasize mixed-use nodes, so we have a variety of different uses in these areas of higher intensity, like in the downtown, like the main 522 interchange, and also along the commercial stretch of the US 2 corridor, finding ways to increase the efficiency of land use, and also really take advantage of your environmental location. Last time we were together, you were talking about gateways as a concept, and that interface between the natural element and the urban element is really a very profound component of this plan, so we want to make sure we have policies that take advantage of that.
Mr. Graham?
Yes.
Mr. Grimes, Councilmember Gehring.
Thank you. Just a quick question. So increased complexity, can you tell me a little bit more about that again?
I think that deals with the diversity of land use, and some of the, particularly in the downtown area, where we're wanting to make sure that we're able to incorporate the type of housing and type of commercial and professional office in a more concentrated area, which really makes the land use pattern a little bit more complex in these more intensely developed nodes.
More complex, multiple types of land use within a smaller area. As that defining what complex is. Very good. Okay.
That's what I'm after.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
You know, and even in some of the other areas, I'm thinking about Fairgrounds, which is outside of the city limits but still within our planning area, we anticipate that may evolve into be more of a complex space as well. More activities, more year-round orientation. So there's a little bit more synergy.
Thank you.
So as we look at this and how this really takes shape in different areas, we see that we've got a strategic focus on the airport and the fairgrounds and how that's going to evolve over the years. This is nothing new. We've talked about this throughout the entire process. But, you know, is the airport nearing the end of its strategic life cycle? If so, what is that beginning to look like down the road? Increasing the interface to the river as a celebration to Monroe's proximity to the environment, increasing the dynamic livability and liveliness of your downtown as part of it, and also seeing what we can do about that stretch of West Main runs from the downtown to the 522 freeway interchange. You've got some land uses that are evolving there, houses that are converting into professional office, new multifamily development occurring there. It's becoming really more of a civic urban corridor, so how do we have policies that help that along? So as part of this, we have several new comprehensive plan map designations, and as David was talking about in his introduction, it really is something of a new canvas here, and I'll talk about that here in a bit, but if you look at this comprehensive plan and compare it to your existing comprehensive plan, you'll see that we do have new names for things. We have a tourist commercial designation that applies to the extreme northwest of town, fairgrounds, and the airport. A low-density single-family residential that really applies to the low-density single-family residential development that's either in place or planned, generally north of Highway 2 and west of 522. Medium-density single-family residential, high-density single-family residential, multifamily, shoreline industrial, institutional, transportation. We tried to make these names a little bit more intuitive in character that would describe what the land uses are there today. Also, somewhat aspirational to see what it is that we'd like to see over the next 20 years. One of the reasons for doing this is that the existing comprehensive plan land use designations that are being replaced
Mr. Grimes?
Yes.
Sorry, I kind of wait for you to transition and then I call on council members. Councilmember Gehring?
Back on the previous, I wanted to institutional. I was thinking maybe that's the prison, but I'm trying to figure out what else that might mean if it's a map designation.
Yeah, the institutional land use category also includes the prison, but it also includes schools, it includes other large significant public facilities, things that have a level of public ownership or are... If you were to have a large church facility or conference center, that also could be conceived as an institutional use, something that has a dedicated public purpose and is now a consolidation of several existing institutional uses or public facilities uses in that category.
Interesting. Look forward to a little more conversation on that one as we figure out a little bit more about what that is. It's certainly an interesting topic. I hadn't heard that one before, so... I'd be interested to see a little bit more verbiage about what that one's going to be like. So I appreciate the information. Thank you.
Before you move on to the next slide, I think that institutional right now, I think the fairgrounds is identified as institutional in our current zoning code. Is that the case?
I don't think we have institutional.
It's that green.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different...
Parks and open space.
I must be thinking of a different comp plan from another jurisdiction.
A special regional use that also includes your transportation for your major.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, and if I could ask one more time, the shoreline industrial, I was certainly thinking like shoreline commercial. What would shoreline is shoreline industrial Lake Tai? Oh, that's Cadman.
Shoreline industrial is applied specifically to the Cadman.
Cadman. Got it. Okay. Okay.
And that really institutionalizes its transition from a mining to a processing facility.
Got it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense then. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, and so the deleted map designations, you see the public facilities designation is the one that generally comes into the institutional land use category. Limited open space airport is deleted and included in the tourist commercial designation. Service commercial is deleted and becomes part of an overall general commercial designation. Professional office is deleted, and that's finding itself also in commercial designations and also in the downtown. And then we have our residential designations, where these are density-based residential designations that are not necessarily in sync with the way the land has developed over time. And it's not necessarily consistent with our transition from a net density to a gross density calculation of development yield. So the R2 to 5 is saying 2 units to 5 units per acre. R3 to 5 is 3 to 5 units per acre. So these are essentially combined into the low density single family category. This would be your medium density, and then this would be your high density single family. The North Kelsey and North Plan development areas are also deleted, and they're incorporated in the more generalized land use designations. However, some of the policies from the North Kelsey plan are repeated in the comprehensive plan, but some of those really are still relevant into the development of that overall area.
Thank you. Councilmember Gamble and then Councilmember Gehring.
So we were just pointing to the map in the back. That's the old map designation in the back and the color scheme associated with said designations.
Yes.
So if I look back there right now, currently schools, public, that's the current one right there we're looking at? Okay. So schools would be... So basically where I'm going with this is that prisons, fairgrounds, everything will have the same color. Okay.
So if you, this is your existing map. This is what is proposed. And I don't intend for this to be readable, but what we have done is that we have gone through and figured out where the new and the old conflict, or at least are different in name. And so in some of the darker colors, the crosshatches is a little bit more pronounced. If you take a look at the area that is proposed for institutional, you can see a crosshatch in there faintly. And so we understand the geographic scope of the change. But that doesn't necessarily tell us if it's a significant change or a relatively minor one. So these areas that I'm denoting with the green buttons are areas where the changes are relatively insignificant, where we're looking at changes in a land use designation or land use title that really closely conforms to the previous comprehensive land use designation. So the single family, low density residential, both here in the northern areas and then also in Frylands, very, very similar to what's on the books now. Right now you've got a 2-5 and a 3-5. We've essentially combined those and colored them yellow, given them a new title. And then also the incorporation of the service commercial area into a general commercial designation, too.
Can I just have a council member here?
Okay.
If you're not answering.
And if you could go back to that, I'm sorry.
Jason, we're going to council member. Do you have anything else, council member? Okay, council member here.
The list before we had the map. If you could go back to that, just
for a second.
Limited open space airport as going away. So that now becomes tourist commercial. And I would want to make sure that an operating airport can still happen inside tourist commercial. If they actually end up ever being able to widen their runway just a little bit or whatever, things, you know, there was talk of a restaurant, a hotel. I mean, those are things that would work with the fairground anyway.
Right.
If that plan that we, you know, whether it ever comes to fruition, as long as those types of things are still possible. And I'm assuming that's kind of what tourist commercial means, is people coming, they're going to the fairgrounds, they're going to, you know, we had heard, you know, man cave and restaurant and hotel and, you know, widen the runway a little bit. When we see this and we have a list of, you know, uses, I mean, that's going to be things we have to do afterwards. I'm assuming this passes and then here's what kinds of things can happen in each one of these designations, right?
Correct, and that's what David was hinting at, is right. That there is going to need to be an audit of the existing zoning designations to make sure that the districts are consistent with the overall
components. My only concern is not losing what we have now. It is something that makes this area unique, and whether that, you know, ends up being what it ends up being in the future or not, I don't want to adversely affect, you know, existing things. And so while that's going away, just a note on tourist commercial needs to include the uses that are there now. Lisa would be my preference.
Yes, absolutely. And that was really one of the foundational principles of that.
Okay.
And also finding a way to really encourage the continue or enhance the relationship between the airport and the fairgrounds.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. I think that's a great idea.
Early on, one of the things that we wanted to make certain is that this airport's different than other airports, and that other airports receive FAA funding. So there's a different type of airport there. If the property owner, so it's privately owned, if the property owner wanted to convert that to something different, we wanted to make certain that opportunity was there for it to become hotels or whatever the case may be. And one of the benefits to that happening is that it removes some of the regulations that that make it so you can't develop the areas off of the taxiway and the runway system at a higher and better use. So as an example, the old cement
Masonry plant.
I thought you said mystery plant. The old masonry plant at the intersection of Frylands and / Roosevelt and Highway 2 can't be developed for, I guess, hotels or something like that right now because it's underneath the, you know, the takeoff area. So,
there's ways around the overlay, but yeah, that is a bummer.
Okay, so there may be other areas of town that are equally impacted. So if there's a desire for the airport to become something different, there are some benefits to the community from that happening. We would like them to the way that we've approached this is to, and what I heard from the public in the CAC meetings was to help facilitate that becoming a different use if they so chose. Again, because it is private as opposed to being public with FAA funding, it's a little different than Harvey Airfield or Payne Field or something.
And my only last question is, so this is draft, and at some point it will be final. I mean, we have a couple areas on the map that may or may not change color and all those kinds of things, given certain timing. So assuming that's all accommodated for here at some point when we get the June 30th version, I guess. So all right. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, there's time to adjust and make changes, certainly. This is a draft, and I imagine the Planning Commission recommendation would look like something. Something like this when it comes to you, and you can adjust as you see fit. The time, the orange buttons indicate where changes are a little bit more significant. But the time may not now be ripe to think strategically about the airport and the fairgrounds and how to tie those things together. But it probably will be within the next 20 years within the scope of this plan. And so we wanted to set up some kind of a foundation so that conversation could happen. And so we do see a significant land use change in this area to reflect that thinking. Moving south, we also see a degree of change related to the opportunities for possibility of a mixed use development on the 179 US 2 intersection, just opposite the entry to the fairgrounds and alongside the hospital. Encouraging some level of activity there. Now, the fairgrounds just recently has gone through its master planning process, and there's more and more emphasis on that intersection as an access to the fairgrounds, so it seems like a nice companion on the south side of the highway, and also an opportunity to really monument an entry into Monroe as you start to get into areas of intensity there. So that's one of the reasons why we have this area change. The multifamily land use designation becomes slightly more intense than its existing comprehensive plan category, but it actually is a more accurate reflection of what has been developed on the ground. We're saying up to 25 units per acre is that density or intensity proposed in the comprehensive plan, and it really does reflect in large extent what is built there now. We've also taken a look at your infill development standards and how those may apply to this area, and we've put together a single family high density land use designation that helps to support that. It's kind of an interesting turnabout where zoning has helped to inform a comprehensive plan designation, where we wanted to make sure we were embracing the intent behind your infill development standards and put together a land use designation that helps you achieve it. So we've got a land use designation that actually talks about some of those compatibility issues and begins to translate some of those zoning ordinance types of things into more of a policy language. And then also looking at the intersection of West Main and 522, so we could take advantage of that freeway access for some more economic development activity and non-residential development, particularly on the west side of the highway. So that's an area where we see a little bit more of a change. So what are we doing now? We're working with the Parks Board so they can complete the review of their plan. They've actually gone through at a fairly detailed level, both the Parks Recreation Open Space Plan and also the Parks Recreation Open Space Element. So they'll give you some feedback on that. It'll go through the Planning Commission and then come to you. The Planning Commission is working on its recommendations, we told you before. And then we're waiting for comments from the state agencies. We're not smack dab in the middle. We're about two-thirds of the way through the 60-day review comment period. And so we'll get comments June 2nd from our agency colleagues before June 2nd and have to respond to those. We're also going to be getting some comments from PSRC. We're continuing to get public comment. Planning Commission had a public hearing again last night and received testimony from an individual that essentially repeated some testimony they've already heard in a previous meeting. When we get all of the comments in house, we'll prepare our final environmental impact statement, which will be an addition of a couple of pages to the EIS in the April 3rd draft. And then it'll come back to you for your hearing and your action. And then we have to make sure that we send it off to PSRC for certification and that we get it to Department of Commerce for their filing as well. So that's our trajectory through the end of the comprehensive plan process. But it is our trajectory through the adoption of the comprehensive plan and that part of the process. There is the implementation that's implied. The plan is only as good as its implementation. It's the mantra. It's what I say 5 times to myself every time before I go to sleep. So we have four things that are going to be front of mind when you adopt your plan: the development regulations, how you actually implement this in terms of the budgets, how you invest in your capital improvements, and how you work with your partners to invest in their capital improvements to get the plan in place. And then some of those other program things as they come up that will help you advance the plan too. We talked about the airport and the fairgrounds. One of the implementation things that we're talking about in the plan is actually doing some of that strategic thinking about what needs to happen. Doesn't mean it has to happen right away, but it is something that's on the list that's really important to fulfilling the plan's objectives and setting a course for what's going to happen in that area. So some of these things are long-term, some of these things are more immediate. And wanted to focus on the development regulations here a little bit and give you a preview of what you might be looking at as an immediate request for work to get them to make sure your zoning and development regulations are in compliance with the comprehensive plan. Right now you have an array of zoning districts, and they generally conform to the land use designations. But it may be time to go through and make sure that they're named correctly, that they're actually named in a way that's going to be intuitive and consistent with what the comprehensive plan is talking about, and then make sure that your density allowances in those districts is consistent with what the comprehensive plan communicates. You know, we made the move to go into gross density, which means that the density, land use density and development density of community in the comprehensive plan includes the yield that you're going to get, including what you have to dedicate for critical areas and for roads and other open space requirements and other constraints. But your zoning isn't necessarily worded that way. And so the staff is going to have to go through and make sure that your zoning minimum lot sizes are consistent with the intensities in the comprehensive plan. Now, in our first review, they're pretty close. They really are pretty close. The ranges of the comprehensive plan are somewhat broader, though, than what you have in your zoning density. So, an alignment, I think, is probably in order. So that'll be a change both to the map and to the text to make sure that the density requirements or the density allowances and entitlements are consistent. And in the zoning text, this is something that is just going to be probably more of a clerical task than a substantive one, is making sure that your zoning cross-references for those provisions that relate to zoning titles are all in order. Your sign ordinance relates to zoning sections by name. Your PRD ordinance relates to zoning districts by name. So you just make sure that those cross-references are working. So that's kind of a technical issue, but it's certainly something that needs to be done. I think that the most important consideration is making sure that your zoning entitlements align with the comprehensive plan. Now, for the most part, these areas that have been changed are generally already built or already subdivided. So I don't know that there's going to be much of a political repercussion, but there certainly is a material one in terms of the zoning work that you're going to be looking forward to do. So some of the long-term issues is taking a look at the sub-areas and corridors that emerge, whether it's the tourist commercial area around the airport and the fairgrounds, or whether it's the West Main corridor, or whether it's the mixed-use district, the 179th, or whether it's the downtown. Just having those strategic conversations over time here to make sure that all your comprehensive plan and zoning objectives are in sync. And then also taking a look at the zoning text. It's almost a management issue to make sure that you're really taking this opportunity to implement best zoning practices overall. Your comprehensive plan and the way that you've gone about preparing your comprehensive plan in light of an economic development strategy, capital facilities plan, parks and recreation plan really is somewhat progressive, and so it's opened the door for you to also bring your zoning code into that kind of step as well. Okay, so more nuts and bolts.
Councilmember Gehring.
I really appreciate that so far. Actually, kind of a combination question. One, Chief Silva mentioned something about Frylands and where you guys have a piece of property in the Frylands. Is that in the industrial area, or is that in the... So it is in the industrial area already. I just want to make sure it wouldn't require some sort of a zoning change if the fire department needed to build something there, because so it wouldn't be in what would be considered the residential area now. Okay, good. All right.
It's in the industrial park.
So it's already in the industrial park, then not an issue. Yeah, otherwise, that wouldn't match right off the bat. I was thinking, that was my question. Thank you.
Are there any other, is this time for discussion? Okay, are there any other questions, comments, council? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you very much, Mr. Grimes.
Thank you.
All right, the next item on the agenda, and before I move on to the next item on the agenda, I'm going to note right now that we do have an executive session that we are going into. It'll involve a teleconference, and that will occur at 8:30. So wherever we are in the conversation, right around 8:25, I will remind everybody, and again, we'll be moving to e-session at 8:30 for that. The next item that we have on our agenda is under new business. This is AB 15089, setting the date for consideration of the Hoserland preliminary plat and planned residential development. Mr. Osaki.
Mayor, council members, the hearing examiner held a public hearing on the Hoserland preliminary plat PRD last month. He issued his recommendation on April 30th in accordance with the municipal code. We as staff bring this hearing examiner recommendation to you, the council, in order to set a date for your formal consideration of the hearing examiner's recommendation. So what staff is recommending in the agenda bill is that you as a council set next week, Tuesday, May 19th, as the date for your consideration of the hearing examiner's recommendation, in part because the city attorney will be here at that meeting, and also because since you're giving some consideration to possibly canceling your May 26th meeting, this enables the applicant to get a decision from the council sooner rather than later.
All right, Councilmember Gehring.
Thank you. I move to set the date of May 19th, 2015 for closed record consideration of the hearing examiner's recommendation on the Hoserland preliminary plat and preliminary PRD.
Second.
Yeah, I have a first from Councilmember Gehring, and I have a second from Councilmember Gamble. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. The next item on the agenda is under new business. This is AB 15090, discussion sidewalk regulations. Mr. Feilberg.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. As you're well aware, we are widening the sidewalks along Main Street in downtown, and one of the reasons for doing that is to allow for the use of the sidewalks by the adjacent businesses. It's currently not specifically allowed by the Monroe Municipal Code. The proposed draft regulations that you received with the council packet are sort of a starting point for you to consider what you'd like to have done down there. Things to consider are what area would you like this to be allowed in. Right now, the only place with the wider sidewalks are the two blocks of Main Street, but would you like to also consider this for other things to be done in other places in downtown, or just currently limited to that the plaza area? What kind of licensing or permits do you want to have that might look that you want to kind of tied to a business license, or you'd like to have it more along the lines of a right-of-way disturbance permit, which is also included. Those current regulations are also included in your packet. What would the width of the passable sidewalk be? So how much would the adjacent businesses be allowed to use? How long are the permits good for, or the license, however they ended up? Is it good for a season? Is it good for a year? You know, is it good for until they don't use it? Hours of operation, the sample you have has to tell me stuff has to be come out half an hour before they open it, and has to be gone a half hour after they close. Would you like to allow them to have some, you know, set up kind of to, especially for dining establishments, to set up their dining area that they could keep up all the time, or allow them to have more substantial furniture if you have large tables or something out there, we kind of hard to pack them up and put them inside every night. who's to administer this within the city, and how to appeal it, and how to enforce people who don't do it. And I don't know if you'd like to have the...
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is invite the committee, P4 committee met and talked about this today. And so we'd like to have the committee chair, Rasmussen, go ahead and just give an update of that conversation, a couple of the to-do items that staff will be looking into. And, of course, council then, as a body, will go ahead and discuss and follow up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. So as the mayor did say, we discussed this in committee this evening. And I think the biggest thing we were curious about is the draft policy that we're looking at tonight was taken from Longview. It's a variation of theirs, and so we were curious of reaching back out to them and kind of hearing back as far as the pros and cons that they've experienced having this, maybe talking to their chamber, so have that local business feedback as well, just get an idea of how this all goes into play. Would certainly love to have, once this staff has a chance to get back to us and based off of any further discussions that we have tonight, of course, bring this back for public comment period before we go finalize everything. What am I missing?
Councilmember Cuddebeck?
Just that we wouldn't ask for a public hearing. We'd ask for public comment, which we thought was a more appropriate way to meet our timeline of trying to get this adopted by mid-June, and that way we would advertise for public comment but not follow the process of a public hearing. So
we have a little bit more latitude in issuing the public notice for a public comment as opposed to public hearing, which, because of how things get published and whatnot, instead of the 15 days required by code, it ends up being 21 days or something. So
but still get the word out that we really want public comment and not it appear rushed or that we're not asking for it, but really give that time. And I think one more comment was finding out kind of the insurance requirement for businesses and looking into that so we would know really what was required, so we could just be aware of that, how it's going to affect maybe small business downtown for that.
I'll go ahead and add a couple items also. So I had 26 copies. I was able to hand this out to 26 of the businesses in the downtown. With a cover letter, I emailed a copy of that to council on Friday so that you could see that. I then went back and touched base with a couple of business owners on Saturday. Andrew from the bakery had expressed a question, had inquired with me about the insurance requirement. That was the one comment that I heard. I did have somebody express to me that we probably could go to 5 feet. The way that the current draft is, the business would have to keep 7 feet from the middle of the bollards inward toward their business, free for people to walk back and forth. And that's a good amount of area where maybe three people could comfortably walk, so a couple walking one way and another one walking the other. 5 feet, I think, is what the standard is that we have on even most sidewalks, probably in front of your house. Does that sound about right? So just to give you some perspective, 5 feet, that's pretty much two people walking side by side. What was expressed to me is that we could probably do 5 feet in the downtown rather than 7 feet. And, of course, that's a policy choice for council. The thing about the 7 feet is that in the downtown where you've got 15 feet, 7 feet taken back gives you 8 feet, and 8 feet is roughly where the existing light posts are. The light posts are going to be about 8 feet from the face of the buildings, and so it makes it somewhat simple to be able to identify whether or not somebody is, well outside of the 8 feet or not, even though they'd apply for a permit and everything. If somebody puts something out there and it looks like it's a little bit far, the light posts will be an option to a measuring tape. But again, it would be a policy choice for council, 7 feet, 5 feet, whatever the case may be. I think that's all of the additional information that I had to offer. And
One more that, I'm sorry, that we quickly talked about was, this applies to Main Street, obviously, with the changes, but are we applying this to
Lewis?
A bigger part of downtown Lewis Street, so that's a question that needs to be answered by council.
And keep in mind, the sidewalks are obviously narrower.
Right.
Outside of Main Street after this project's done, so
yeah.
We have to look at that.
To give you one item, in front of Adams on Lewis Street, I think that's 10 feet. So along Lewis Street, there are areas we have 10 feet. And so applying the 7-foot or 5-foot rule, whatever it is you do, that again gives you 10 minus whatever it is the passable required area is for people to walk back and forth. So last item, I guess, parallel parking. If you were to consider that, so Lewis Street is going to have parallel parking. If you have the 10-foot width and then you require them to have 5 feet on the outside, remember people will be parking parallel. Their doors will open, and you know, with 5 feet right there, the door is going to open partway into the area that people are walking. So that's the only thing that I would point out, where you have a 10-foot sidewalk, or even the 15-foot sidewalk. But you know, just one other thing to consider there. I think that's all I had. Does anybody have any questions for the committee, or for me, or for staff? And just immediate clarification, and then we'll go to Councilmember Camp. Okay, done. Councilmember Kemp.
Thank you. And thank you. Very informative. Brad, you touched on this, but you were talking about having the big tables or something relatively permanent. In Duval, we saw one example where they had a gated area. I didn't know if that was even being considered or if that was going to be an option. I was wondering if we were going to include that. Or your opinion would be...
Yeah, and that's the way the regulations are written. Everything except for planters 2 feet in diameter or less have to be removed half hour after business closes.
Okay.
But that's just the way Longview did it.
Right.
So, you know, it's not.
Can we contact Duval and find out what the regulations are? That in particular, the gated area?
Yes.
You know.
Yes, absolutely. And we that was one other thing that was discussed in committee, and one thing that I concurred with committee. You know, it is a policy choice, so I don't need to, but I concur that is something that we're interested in doing in the downtown. And so staff will follow up with Duval. I know that Everett does the same thing, and just find out what it is they do to put permanent structures out there. Again, we've got to be able to remove them.
Right.
Yeah, temporary permanent. So, yes. Yeah, they're not going to be bolted down into our sidewalk, which I think, I suspect the Duval Tavern is bolted down.
Right, that's what I was wondering.
I've seen up in Everett where I think they've got maybe concrete, you know, concrete blocks, and then they've got a 4x4 post that's maybe 3 feet high that is in that, and then rope in between them.
I didn't know if there was a special property requirement or something where in Duval where they're saying that this is part of their establishment, so that's all I can add.
Talked about that too.
Yeah, so staff will come back with more information on that, and it was for that reason that because I know that staff will go back, research those items. Staff and I know that we'd like to have that in the draft, so we'll go ahead and have that draft revised, and then we'll bring it back to council for another touch before we do the public notice. And if we end up missing the June 30th, you know, certainly we'd like to hit June 30th so that we can do this effective June 30th, but if it takes just a little bit longer to make certain that the product that you want, that I want, gets noticed, we'd like to make certain we do that.
And if I understand correctly, so where the existing street lights are out to the bollards is 7 feet. That's the 7-foot section?
Yes. Is that yes?
Yeah, more or less.
More or less, well, yeah. No. 6 inches more or less.
That's
We've
fine.
Got an engineer out there.
That's fine. Thank you. That's all.
Are there any other questions or comments from council? Okay, so you've heard what the process is going to be from here. Mr. Feilberg will go ahead and collect some additional information, probably work with Mr. Osaki and a couple of other jurisdictions. We will have the draft rules revised to allow for permanent, semi-permanent uses out there. And they'll be back to you in the next couple of council meetings, and then if you all are fine with the way the policy looks, we'll go ahead and schedule a public comment period with a notice. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the next item then, and thank you very much.
The next item that we have on our agenda is under final action. This is request waiver of frontage improvements for Tractor Supply. And is this Mr. Feilberg?
Tractor Supply is in for a building permit application to put the new Tractor Supply, which is Bill's Farm Supply, across or behind the Jack in the Box at Roosevelt and Highway 2. Part of our municipal code requires the installation of a sidewalk or walkway as a condition of a building permit in commercially zoned properties. They have asked for a waiver from having to do the sidewalk, which staff is recommending approval of. The reasons for that is that there is a sidewalk from Highway 2 up to that intersection of foothills. There is already a walkway of at least 5 feet wide of shoulder for people to walk up on the east side of, the west side of Roosevelt Road. There's not a large concentration of people up there on that side of the road, and the materials that they generally sell there, you're not going to walk down and sort of look up, be able to pay home. So there's not really a nexus or proportionality for doing that amount of work. And also, if they were adding a sidewalk, it would actually require some fill to be done on that site, which would be very expensive. So the cost of doing the sidewalk improvements versus the cost of their building project is relatively high. So staff is requesting that the council approve the waiver. Mr. Mayor, if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
But before I call on council members, I do have one question. Are we going to be requiring lights as part of the frontage improvements that right across from Foothills Road?
Lights at the intersection of Foothills Road and Roosevelt Road is a requirement of that project. So the intersection illuminated, but not along the Roosevelt Road going north.
I'm sorry. Is the proposed project adding streetlights
at the intersection?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it is adding streetlights.
Just at the intersection, not all the way along the frontage.
Yeah. Okay. I want to make sure I understood that correctly. Okay. And lastly, so you don't see a need for having any sidewalks on Roosevelt Road?
Not after their driveway.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Councilmember Gehring.
Thank you, Mayor. Let me scroll back up to what I was going to say because I scrolled down from there. I move to waive the requirement of constructing sidewalk along the public right-of-way frontage along Roosevelt Road associated with application number 2006.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Gehring, a second from Councilmember Cutaback. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, thank you. So just to clarify, Brad, they're still going to put sidewalk from Jack in the Box corner up to their driveway?
Oh, that already exists.
It's already there.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Rasmussen.
Brad from Tractor Supply, continuing on Roosevelt. I mean, obviously, right now there's not much there. Remind me, zoning-wise, what could potentially be there?
Well, on that side of the road is outside the urban growth area and outside city limits,
okay.
So it'll be very low density. The higher density, both Bear Mountain Flat and the Hoseman Flat, which we just set the date for, are on the east side of the road.
Okay.
So for pedestrians, it would be appropriate to have, and both of those flats are putting sidewalks on the east side of Roosevelt Road.
Okay. I guess I see the appropriateness today, but future thinking down the road is...
As we continue to grow, is there going to be a need for a sidewalk, and are we shooting ourselves in the foot by not requiring it today? To me, I think of the West Main Street sidewalk from Monroe Family Village to the high school, and didn't it take a grant recently to complete that sidewalk? Without that grant, would that sidewalk be getting complete? I guess that's my concern, is I don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot today going for future thinking here. So that's my concern.
Brad, have there been any comments received by anybody on this project or anything like that? Great. Are there any other questions or discussion from council? Okay, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, motion passes 6-0. All right, next item on the agenda is councilmember reports. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. I'm going to hit pause for a second. Are we able to give her a call a couple minutes early?
Absolutely.
Okay. What we're going to do right now is we're going to move into executive session for approximately 10 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry, for approximately 15 minutes. The RCW citation is RCW 42.30.110, subsection 1, subsection C, for pricing of property. There will be action to follow. And we will need Mr. Osaki, Mr. Feilberg, Chief Quinzer, and I think that's it.
I didn't know that.
I have talent.
All right, we're back in regular session out of executive session. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, I move to add consideration of resolution number 009-2015 to the May 12th. 2015 City Council meeting agenda.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Hanford, a second from Councilmember Camp. Any discussion on the motion to add this to the agenda? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, I move to approve resolution number 009-2015, authorizing the sale of certain real property to Irwin Development Group, LLC.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Hanford. I have a second from Councilmember Gehring. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead now and move into Councilmember reports. And before we do that, we'll go through the committee report. Committee Chair Rasmussen, do you have anything? Or Councilmember Cutterback, anything additional?
Nothing further than the sidewalk discussion.
All right, sounds good. So now we'll go to individual council members. Councilmember Gehring.
Thanks. The end of the high school sports season here in town. I just, on a side note, would like to say that congratulations to the Monroe Lacrosse High School lacrosse team, which made the playoffs for the first time ever this year. So congratulations.
Awesome. Councilmember Gamble.
Yeah, actually. So the Little League this last weekend, this is the first, one of the first years in a long time we started interleaguing at the youth level with the hated rival to the west. That would be Snohomish. And there was a clean sweep in the ranks of the minor leagues on Saturday. So it was a good day out at the ballparks, both in Snohomish and here. And then Mother's Day was the second annual Mother's Day game for Legends Boys up at the Monroe at Rotary. The field was great. It was a great day up there, and really nice to always a good room to be able to use the restrooms that we got installed up there. And it was nice for the moms to have. That was the first year we've had, obviously, the restrooms for the Mother's Day baseball game. So that was really nice. That's it.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Yes, thanks. It's my understanding that Councilmember Gamble, Councilmember Davis, and Councilmember Camp filed for money, and I'm very satisfied to hear that. So that's it.
Thank you. Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. It's been an interesting week. Last Thursday, I went to the National Day of Prayer activity and saw quite a few people here. And I'd just like to comment on Councilmember Gehring representing Cascade Church. Gave a very nice presentation, very nice speech. The activity, it was well done, and I look forward to next year. The mayor and I visited, and city staff visited Take the Next Step last Friday. I was amazed at all that they can accomplish with the limited resources they have. I'm looking forward to their presentation June 2nd.
Somewhere thereabouts, yes.
Right.
June 2nd or 9th.
Something like that. And lastly, I believe this Saturday is the Monroe High School prom. I want to wish everyone the best, that they have a nice, safe, and fun evening. And that's it. Thank you.
Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. Just had a great weekend coaching. Finally, you know, those of you that coach, you've had those games or those moments where you think everything just finally clicks. And we had that weekend, last weekend, where it was just phenomenal. You know, kids that are no more than knee high are actually out there on the field and understanding and getting it. It was great. And then Mother's Day weekend, perfect weekend for it. It was plus I didn't have to work, and so it was very good. So that's my report.
Those moments are like a golf game, though.
Yeah. A little worried about this weekend.
Councilmember Cutterback.
On Thursday last week, I attended the YWCA luncheon at Xfinity Arena, and it had over 700 people. It was great. Great organization. Been in Snohomish County, I think, over 100 years. So was really inspired by the testimonial, so it was great, great function. And I had a wonderful Mother's Day. That's it. Yeah. My husband was smart and sent me a bouquet of flowers from the kids. So. Very smart.
Great. Ms. Worthen.
Tonight I did, well, I guess I do have something. I'm working on setting up the Facebook accounts for those that wanted them. So I'm working on that. It's a little bit of it's different than setting up your own personal Facebook account. So it's a little bit of a learning curve. So just be patient. I should have it hopefully done by the end of this week. And then I'll have it.
Thank you. Mr. Farrell.
Yes, thank you. As you see, place these in your envelopes. I'm sorry, in your mailboxes. And we're going to be mailing out about close to 9,000 of these to the greater community. These parts of brochures for this season. And as you can see, when you open up this weekend, got a stack of events. One is, well, there's the City of Monroe Spring Cleanup. It's on the 16th.
That's right. I forgot to say that.
And then also on the 16th is Proctor Hill 5K. And then on the 17th is the Bark for Life at Lakeside Park. And then next week, this upcoming year, is the Westco Fast Pitch District Tournament. It'll be at Scarborough Park. And then in other news, this Thursday, members of the Monroe Garden Club will be potting up flowers for downtown. And that's a project that we get assistance from Lowe's, who sells the flowers and also potting soil at cost. And then also Pine Creek Nursery discounts flowers as well. And we got contributions of $500 each from both the Monroe Garden Club and Republic Services.
Thank you. Mr. Osaki.
Over the last week, we actually received the final plat application for Eaglemont Division 2. So the final plat being, we as staff will review it for consistency and compliance with the preliminary plat decision. And it looks good. We'll bring it to council for final approval. And I believe that's about 40 to 50 lots.
Okay. How are other reviews going?
They're going.
Okay.
It's busy.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Chief Quinzer?
Saturday we had a first degree assault up at the prison. Suspect was apprehended, and it will probably turn into homicide sometime this week, and it has less than 5% chance of surviving. So, keep you updated.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Feilberg?
Yes, downtown, Main Street Plaza Project, the paving blocks of the south side of East Main are imminent.
They're imminent.
They were hoping to get started this afternoon, but I think the phone call was that it did, so hopefully they'll start putting those in tomorrow so you can see what they actually look like.
Okay. I'd like everybody to understand that these are the tiles that cars will be parking on. And these are going on the south side of
East Main? Of East Main, yes.
Okay, and so people will be able to park
parallel park on those at some point?
At some point, yes.
Okay.
I don't know when.
So June 30th, for sure.
June 30th, for sure.
Before then. Okay. And the other one is we're going out to bid tomorrow. The ad is in the paper for the West Main portion of the Main Street Plaza.
Sounds good.
We hope to have that awarded on the 2nd, so we can start work on July 1st.
So. Sounds good. Does anybody have any questions for staff before we come up here? Councilmember Hanford?
Yes. I'm sure it's in the timelines, and I just can't recall. What's the projected end date of the West Main side?
21st, I think, to August.
And is that the same weekend as the parade?
No, it's the week before.
Okay.
The parade this year is as late as it can get. 29th. So
perfect. So just to make sure I understand correctly, so when the parade happens, if construction doesn't run into problems, should all be put back together and usable.
Yes.
We received an email this week about the idea of having some kind of celebration downtown.
Yes.
And I love that idea. I think it's perfect. And so I don't know if there's a way to tie it into the parade.
Yes. That's what we're. The plan is that at the end of the parade, last year there was a festival that was around Frank Wagner Elementary by the Wagner Arts Center. This year that will be on the west block of West Main. And I will be inviting our senator and our two representatives, our county council member, executive, and you all, of course, and other folks to a dedication ceremony, and then, of course, there will be a festival and whatnot. I know that the chamber has already talked about putting booths out there. We've already received feedback that from Patty, I think it's Gibbons from Heavenly Soap, about the cost of that, and that's something that she's working with the chamber on. But yes, that is what we'll be doing this year. So.
Great. Is that, and I know it's early as far as the time frame, but are you thinking it's going to be part of the parade itself?
It'll be after, just after the parade. Yeah, the thought is it would be just after the parade.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you've got other thoughts, please let me know. And this is something that we're working with the chamber on. So a lot of that is something the chamber is part of. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? So this last week, I also attended the National Day of Prayer, and that was a wonderful service. Councilmember Gehring, thank you for getting up and speaking and representing Cascade, and that was a great service. On Thursday, I also met with Patty from Heavenly Soap and talked with her a little bit about some of the questions and whatnot that she had heard from different people, was able to confirm a couple things that she had heard and also correct a couple things that she had heard. On Friday, I came in for half day and went ahead and wrote the cover memo and got the letters dropped off along with the draft sidewalk regulations that you all saw and spoke about this evening. In the process, I the very last business that I went into, there was a resident that thought that she heard that West Main was going to be completely closed, including the businesses, and I told her that was new news to me and whatnot, and based on how she had presented the information, I contacted Mr. Feilberg, who immediately went down and spoke with Camp 1923, with Colleen, which is kind of where the information sort of was overheard, and got everything corrected there. And did you talk to Las Tres Marias? Okay. Because the information I heard was at Las Tres Marias. So as is common when something happens, there are, you know, things that are overheard, things that are a little bit out of context, and we're trying very hard to make certain that people understand what is accurate information. That's one of the reasons why I've been out doing things, is just to hear what people are hearing and correct or confirm whatever the case may be. But we will not be closing all of West Main. There will be times where there will be closures to the street, and one of the reasons for that is because we are doing both the north and south side at the same time. There are efficiencies gained by being able, in terms of time, not just cost, but in terms of time, being able to go from one side of the street to the other. But as I understand it, it will not be 24-hour closures for 30 days, which is what I heard, and the businesses will not be closed for 30 days, which is the other thing that somebody had said. We'll approach this very much like we did with East Main and Lewis Street, where we will keep as much sidewalk there in front of people's doors, businesses' doors, as we can before pulling that out and putting down concrete. Is that correct?
That is contractor dependent, so it depends on how the contractor wants to do. So if we get the same contractor, I'm assuming we've done the same, another contractor might, you know, rip and pour, you know, 2 days in a row or differently. So
okay. So as is key with where we are right now, and we're very fortunate with a contractor that's been working very well, in my opinion, my estimation, with us and with the downtown businesses, staff will keep us up to date as things shift, and we'll, of course, keep the businesses up to date. But if you've got any questions or anything, please let me know. You know, it's hard for us to correct things on Facebook and whatnot, but I can certainly pick up the phone and call the monitor, or if you know of somebody that's got a question, give them our email addresses, as I know that each one of us has done at some point in time or another, and have them contact us directly. I did invite that resident to email me. She had my card, and as of right now, and that was Saturday, that was Friday, as of right now, I still haven't received an email so that I could provide the accurate information. So we will correct or confirm questions. Also, different subject. This evening, I attended the beginning of the Everett Community College visioning process. They do this, I guess, once per year, and I let them know for council members to attend in future years to maybe move this to not a Tuesday night, preferably a Wednesday or a Thursday, so that school board members can attend also. And so they've made a note on that for future reference. There was a question as to why they hadn't received RSVPs from me or from council, and I expressed that, well, that's our council meetings. So I did go, and I did give a welcome, and then left to be here. Councilmember Gamble.
I was going to say, for the record, they did reach out to several of us.
Okay.
Advised them the same thing.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
There were RSVPs. It was along the same lines. It's a Tuesday night.
Okay. Well, sounds good. They know that we all value the community college, and hopefully in the upcoming years it'll be a Wednesday or Thursday. The flip side of that is you didn't get to see me on video, which is probably a good thing for all of us. So, let me see. Lastly, tomorrow night I'll be attending a Housing Hope dinner up at the Tulalip Indian Casino, I think. And then I am on vacation officially tomorrow, but I'm still in town tomorrow, and then will not be here for about 10 days. So during that time, Mayor Pro Tem Hanford will be your primary contact. Remember, as he is a council member, there's a limit on how many of you can talk to him about a policy matter or whatnot. But if you've got any questions, please contact both City Administrator Brazel and also Mayor Pro Tem Hanford. And Mayor Pro Tem Hanford will be taking the meeting next week. So thank you very much for doing that. If anybody needs me, you can reach me maybe via cell phone. I'll be in deep canyons and whatnot, so you may not be able to reach me. Lastly, I guess on cell phones and text messages, we'll go ahead and segue into that, and then we'll go through the agenda for next week and everything.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Mayor.
Yeah, as technology evolves, so does regulation. One of the things we're wrestling with right now is how to archive text messaging, because it's come to our attention that states put out information. So as MRSC, in the last 30 days, that those things should be monitored. What we've done internally with the staff is we've turned off the text messaging capability for all the staff that work in the field. I think the majority of the management team has turned off the texting ability as well, because if we decide to keep it on board, we can archive it for only $10 a month per phone, so that can add up very quickly. We've elected to move towards just emailing, so use the subject line. If you're going to be late, that type of thing, you can just say, run it 15 minutes late, we'll get in the habit of checking our emails. It's already archived, it's not going to cost us additional dollars. So this evening, that's a question for council members that have cell phones. Is that of interest to switch to an archiving system, which we can do, or just turn off text messaging and just email?
For city phones, yeah. Councilmember Gehring.
Yeah, so this is my mental happening text on it. Maybe so if there's a public records request for it, I mean, don't you just hand the phone over? I mean, what would you do?
We physically have to archive the text messaging. If there is anything that happens on a city phone, we have to be able to reset it. Okay. Public records.
So that's the $10 per month. So we have Postini, which every email that comes in and out of the city servers gets copied for, I think, a decade.
Yeah, right. Smarsh is what we have.
Smarsh. Yeah. Okay, Smarsh.
If you're asking my opinion, I would just say turn off the text
messaging. Turn off.
Okay. Does anybody have an issue with turning off the text messaging? Okay. I will be turning off my text messaging also on my device. So from now on, if you want to reach me, do the subject line. Going to be 15 minutes late, and I'll look at the email instead. That'll save us $10 per each one of us, $80 a month times 12. And if we find out that's not workable, then we can always go back to, always revisit it. Okay, so you can turn off mine then.
Okay. So you're going to be able to do that tomorrow. I will also be out of the office starting first thing in the morning in the back Friday night in town, and I will not have cell service. So,
Deep Canyons?
Yes. Brad will be in town, and Dave will still be here. The chief, Mike, Ben will be out at the end of the week, as will Liz.
Just Thursday to be a chaperone at the zoo, so.
Nice.
So we need caverns.
For anything for administration for the next couple days, contact Brad. Okay.
Then we have the draft agenda for May 9th, 2015. Under announcements and presentations, we have the Smith Valley Indian Education 11th Annual Traditional Power. We have a consent agenda, under new business. We have the draft RFP, State Legislative Lobbying Services. That's already complete, and that will be in front of the committee as well. The discussion for the 2013 comprehensive plan update. And new business, we have Mayor Pro Tem sign 2015 Snohomish County Fair Traffic Control Agreement. If I understand, it's the same agreement that Council's approved years past with a new gate installed. Then in final action, we have approval of a proposal and TRD flat and the Legislative Affairs Committee report. Any additions or deletions?
Councilmember Camp and then Councilmember Gehring.
Thank you. I had a question. I thought we were going to hear something back from H3O on the 19th.
Hey, Mr. Brazel.
Thank you. We have yet to hear back from them. I've reached out to them numerous times to try and get information, specifically the scope, what's going to be included in their proposal, so I can send that on to the city attorney, and I've yet to receive a response from them. So we haven't even started with a contract amendment or anything else because they haven't provided what I've asked. So that's where that's at.
Thank you. And I know that what's that?
Moved to 6.2 is what I saw.
Yeah.
I just hadn't heard anything. That's the only reason I haven't.
I understand that there were two emails that went out last week, and then I'm sure there are additional attempts. But anyway, that's where things are. And if again, we'll let you know as soon as we get material. In addition to that, we had already, Gene had already sent a packet of material, all the background information to our attorney so that they're ready to go as soon as we get the information. So we've done, I think, everything that we can do up to this point. So that's where things are. Yeah. So for May 26th, it's going to be helpful for staff to know as early as tonight if it's council's desire to have a meeting on the 26th, because they would normally be preparing staff briefings for that today and tomorrow to include in the packet. So is there a desire to keep the meeting for the 26th? Do we need a motion to cancel? Okay, so if there's an interest to cancel it, we'll need a motion to do that. Councilmember Gamble?
I would move to cancel the May 26th business.
Second.
We have a first from Councilmember Gamble, a second from Councilmember Cuddyback. Any discussion on the motion? Councilmember Gehring?
Thank you. Just curious about Planning Commission stuff, if they're going to be meeting, if there's the only thing I would think would be comprehensive plan related stuff. Otherwise, I'd be in support of canceling it as well. I just didn't know. We talked about extra meetings. You know, they're trying to get something to us by the following meeting.
Right. And actually, if the council cancels the 26th, my hope is to actually use that date to have a planning commission meet.
Oh, perfect then. Okay, then there you go. All right, I'm in support.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. All right, Mr. Brazel? Does anybody have any requests for the extended agenda? All right, seeing none, we already had our executive session for this evening, and I have nothing further for the agenda. Is there a motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Sorry. I have a motion from Councilmember Cuddyback to adjourn, a second from Councilmember Hanford. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. Have a great evening, everybody.